Welcome to another episode of the Growth Focus podcast, where we bring together tech leaders from all across the globe to share their time, their insights and expertise so that we can all grow together in this industry. My name is Gary Lefty, your host, creator and founder of the Authority Accelerator, where we take tech leaders and experts and extend them into the authority status so that they can be seen, they can be heard above the noise of all the other experts. On this episode, I'm extremely happy and really looking forward to having our guest here, Greg Moran. We're going to be talking about all things growth, founders. We're going to be talking about characteristics of success, and we're going to talk about a whole bunch of things that when you're looking to grow and scale your company, this is going to be the episode you do not want to miss. So without further ado, Greg, it's an absolute pleasure having you here. Why don't we start off by you giving us a little bit of an introduction about yourself, how you got started and what you do now?
Yeah, hey, Gary, thanks for having me on. Real pleasure to join you today. So I'm Greg Moran. I'm actually the co-founder of a venture firm called Evergreen Mountain Equity Partners. So we are a very founder-focused early stage C, Series A venture fund, really focused around kind of a unique thesis, which is the future of work, right? So we invest in technologies that are really kind of defining what the future of the workforce will look like over the coming decades. Serial entrepreneur, started, exited multiple businesses along the way before I found myself in the venture world.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, before we dive into your company and what you've learned and insights you can share, as you said, you've had multiple successful exits. What is the biggest lesson you would say? Because there must be so many lessons that you have come across your path over the last few years. But if there was just kicking us off, what was the biggest lesson you've learned in your journey as a founder?
Yeah, I mean, look, one thing I want to say up front, like, sure, I've been very blessed to have a couple really nice exits along the way. I've also had some really not fun exits along the way too, right? It kind of comes with the territory. We talk about, you know, the founder's journey all the time, right? And that's just kind of one part of the journey, and it's a necessary one. I think, you know, if I look back over that career, I think, you know, and starting multiple businesses and when things have worked, when things haven't worked, you know, is really, it's about adaptability, right? It's about just being able to kind of step back, get over yourself for a minute, drop the ego, right? And really be able to kind of, to listen to what the market is telling you. And oftentimes we're hearing things from the market that we don't want to hear. The worst feedback of all is none at all, right? But which is really valuable feedback, especially, you know, when you're talking about growth and things like that. But, you know, it's really stepping back and listening to what the market is telling you, listen to what your trusted advisors are telling you, and really listening to what your gut is telling you, right? And that's that adaptability. It's the ability to just constantly change in the face of the challenges that any startup is really going to throw at you, right? And as you're building something for high growth, I don't care what anybody says. This is not predictable. It's never pretty, right? It never looks like up and to the right. It normally looks like a giant bowl of spaghetti sitting in front of you where you just have no idea where the, you know, one piece ends and the next one begins. And I think it's really kind of the ability to step back and be adaptable to what's happening. I think it's been the biggest lesson among them all.
Well, being adaptable is very apt because your new book, yeah, the Adapt Innovator. Yeah. Why don't we start talking about that? Let's talk about what is your book about? We know it explores the traits of great founders. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and then what are the biggest lessons that you've learned from those founders from your research for that book?
Yeah, you know, I think, I mean, we constantly learn from our founders every day, right? And, you know, and the founders in our portfolio and the founders that I coach and work with, when we first started the venture firm. There's, you know, there's a lot of things you need to get right when you're doing early stage kind of seed and Series A investing. But the two things you really, really can't get wrong are number one, before anything else, you got to pick the right founders, right? Then you get into things like product market fit. Will the market, you know, accept it and things like that? But that ability to pick the right founder and furthermore, to be able to coach and develop founders is so critical. So I mentioned, you know, we have a particular focus on future of work. My background, the companies that I exited were all around HR-related technologies, behavioral assessment, things like that. So what my partner in the fund and I decided to do was take that behavioral assessment background and said, look, we've got to be great at picking the right founders. So let's try to apply science to this, right? So we went out and we worked with a number of industrial psychologists that we've had in the past and that we worked with in the past, and went out and we studied the, you know, dozens of the most successful founders that we can find. And when I say most successful founders, I mean, by any financial metric, they would be crushing it, right? These are multiple nine-figure kind of exit founders, right? Because what we're looking at, well, what are the commonalities? What are the things that those people have in common that maybe, you know, are lacking in people who are getting into the entrepreneurial world, but, you know, really, really struggle, right? And what we found was actually super interesting, because what we saw was, you know, there's this stereotype of the successful founder, right? And people think of like Steve Jobs or Elon Musk or, you know, Jeff Bezos. And look, these are absolutely once in a multi-generation founder. But what we found is that you don't need to be those larger than life personalities to have an extraordinary career. And these are competencies that can be developed and they can be learned. And, you know, I think that was the biggest takeaway from us is there's no stereotype for this, that you can be a really extraordinary founder if there's really, you know, kind of, there's really four pillars that we identified as being really critical. One is this concept of that we call creative resilience, right? And creative resilience is this quality in a founder that the further they get boxed into a corner, the more challenges that come at them, not only don't they kind of crawl into the fetal position, right? They actually get more creative. They get, their solutions get better. They get more acute in their thinking, right? They get this kind of tunnel vision that makes them be able to fight their way out of a corner better than just about anybody else. It's an extraordinary skill that we saw across all of the founders. The second one is really what we call humble assertiveness. And that's what we started out with. That's the ability to listen, right? You don't have to be the smartest voice in the room. You certainly don't have to be the loudest voice in the room. But in those rare times when you have to exert yourself, you're not afraid to pound the table, right? But beside that, you're really focusing on what we call the meta decisions, right? Making like those really, if I think about my career, there's probably four or five decisions that I ever made in any business that really defined the business. The rest was noise. Let the team make micro decisions, free yourself up to make those meta decisions. That's where humble assertiveness really comes in. Third is balanced risk-taking. You don't have to bet the farm every single day. Every day in a high growth company should not be life or death. It shouldn't be. Every decision you make shouldn't be, this is going to make us $1 billion or kill the company. That's not balanced decision. That's not balanced risk taking, right? Have a platform, have the foundation of a solid business, and then run experiments on top of that business to really understand what's going to start to propel it. The thing we tell our founders all the time, Gary, don't go to zero. Right? Like, don't go to zero. Just fight tomorrow, right? Don't kill the business, because if you kill the business, you got nothing left to fight from, right? And the fourth is really around strategic accountability. And we also refer to this as coachability. It's the founder who's not afraid to say, I really screwed this one up, or I just need help, right? It's the founder who that gets themselves in trouble that believes or convinces themselves they know it all, or is just simply too afraid to say, I need help, and be vulnerable, because you have to be. There's no way that you can make every single decision for every single challenge that's thrown at you and be able to do that without the help of people more experienced.
Yeah, I think those are great four pillars there, you know, great insights on there. And a couple stood out to me, having been in the industry now for so long, been around industry so long, is the being the cleverest person in the room, or being too proud to accept help, but thinking that you need to know the answers. Because especially in tech, it's all about how clever I am generally. You know, how clever are you? How clever am I? Because we're the ones creating all the things all the time. We have to be at the forefront. But you're absolutely right. You don't have to be that. You have to have the ability to pound the tables, as you said, but you don't have to be the loudest person, the cleverest person in that room all the time. And then that goes back to the humbleness, as you said, being willing to put your hand up and say, hey, there's some help that I need here. I don't know all the answers. And from those, so those great characteristics. And I think, you know, the those listening from here would, you know, certainly pick up a, probably can see themselves in one of four or all of them somewhere along those lines, you know, where they're missing on that.
Nobody nails all four of these, right? Nobody does. And we're all going to be naturally, you know, great at some, and we're going to struggle with others. And that's the beautiful part of this, right? That was the thing I think for us that was most profound about this model is that, you know, people, again, I go back to those examples of, you know, Jobs and Musk and Bezos and things like that. And these are extraordinary founders. You can't train that, right? Yeah. But you can train these competencies. You can train these pillars. Not everybody is going to be outstanding at it, but you can help make somebody, you can help somebody make better decisions. You can help somebody just shut up once in a while, right? You can help somebody be more vulnerable by showing them it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think that brings us nicely onto our next topic about business growth. There's, you know, I see this day in, day out, no doubt you do as well, Greg. We see so many founders struggle with scaling beyond their initial success. There's always this big blurt out before they have some great success, and then they kind of hit the ceiling. Whether that ceiling be 5 million, whether it be 10 million, it's usually around that level first where they hit this glass ceiling before they break through. From your experience, what are the most common roadblocks that prevent these tech leaders from just having this smooth smash through the roadblock and just getting themselves stuck in their own way?
The pace of learning, right? One of the things that ends up happening when you're in a high growth company, and I've been there, right? I mean, I've experienced this firsthand myself. When you're in a high growth company, the pace at which the business operates, you as a founder have to keep up with that. Your learning has to stay at or ahead of the pace at which the company is moving. So when I say that, you know, there are these inflection points, like you said, Gary, right? It's a million, it's 5 million, it's 10 million, it's 20 million. For me, I hit that inflection point at 50 million, right? Where it just became that it required something different, right? And I think there's two things. Number one, you've got to be honest with yourself. You've got to keep your pace of learning ahead of that. You have to be always planning for that next big milestone. If you're at a million today, be thinking about what do I need to know at 5 million? What do I need to know at 10 million, right? Find coaches, find mentors who can help you with this. That's a really key part of it. But the other part of this, and it's a not too often discussed topic, I think, around entrepreneurship, there's also a time when the business is just going to outgrow you. And you've got to be self-aware, right? You've got to be willing to admit that. There's nothing wrong with that. There's no, you know, that's a badge of honor, not a badge of, you know, disgrace, right? Like I said, for me, it got to a point at 50 million. I said, you know what? I don't like this. I don't know what I'm doing. And there are people far, far, far more qualified than me to be running this. That point, I've seen extraordinary founders who hit that point at 1 million. Not because they weren't intellectually capable, because they didn't want to. They're phenomenal at the 0 to 1 million range, right? That early conceptual, everybody's in the bunker, we're fighting it out. You got to know what that point is, and you got to be willing to admit it. You have to be self-aware enough to admit that. And I think and that's really, you know, I think what it comes down to more than anything else is that awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a really good point. Like you said, the business can outgrow you. And as you say, it's not mentioned. It's not even thought of majority of time. There's this myth that the CEO or the founder must be there to the dying death of the company. You know, either it fails or it gets exited. And, you know, they've got to be there every single day to the grind. And that's when you fall out of love with it. That's when it becomes such a chore, and that's another roadblock and another plateau, you know, and another ceiling that they've got to go through. So that's a really, really good piece of, you know, a thought-provoking insight there. And well, hold on a second. Yeah, where am I in this stage? Where's my company in relation to me, where I am right now?
Right. And do I actually want to progress to the next level? Or do I want to go back to the early stage world, right? That's what happened to me. I mean, I just personal experience. It's exactly what happened to me. I was like, now I'm like a real CEO. This job sucks, right? Like, I'm like a politician now. I'm not a grinding founder, and I want to be the grinding founder again. So, you know, went back to kind of square one. And my square one was a little bit different. It was working with early stage founders, but you just have to know where you are. If you want to move to that next level, do it by all means, but be honest with yourself. And if that's not appealing to you, go backwards. It's a perfectly fine strategy for a founder.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let's stay on the topic of growth. You know, what are you seeing now, having had your experiences, like you say, great exits, not so great exits. You know, things come and go, things work, strategies fall out of favor and do not work. In the current marketplace, what business growth strategies are you seeing that really works well in the tech industries today?
You know, I think one of the things that we're seeing right now, which is super interesting, and I know you're in this world, so I'd love to hear your perspective on this too, Gary, is this, you know, there's really kind of two things. I think they're happening. They're interrelated, right? One is obviously the growth of AI. I don't think, you know, if I look at it from an investor lens, I think anyone who's telling you the impact that AI is going to have on the startup world is just lying. I mean, the pace of change is so great right now that it's going to cause a massive disruption for non-AI companies. And I don't really know yet what the pace of what that disruption is going to look like, but it's going to be really big. The other thing, and I feel like these two things are linked, right, is this kind of breakdown in SaaS. Where, you know, as the world was, you know, we were going through the kind of economic boom and things, CFOs and, you know, were not afraid to just buy the, you know, license the next tool and license. And suddenly you end up with this tech stack where you're paying all these licenses that are, you know, huge, right? And, you know, when you look at it, 80%, 90% of the functionality of those technologies not even getting used. And I think now you're starting to see, and we're starting to see this in some of our enterprise portfolio companies, this real pushback around, you know what, this kind of traditional SaaS licensing model may not make the sense that we thought it did. And we want to start to look at some kind of hybrid pricing around, yeah, we're willing to pay maybe a little bit of a subscription price, but we also want to pay for value. And I think those two things are going to be huge drivers as we kind of look at what the next few years of growth within high growth companies, right? Growth within venture backed and
companies. Yeah, I can definitely say from my experience from this, the SaaS model is almost over that bell curve now. It's on its way down. We have to start seeing people are looking for different things. And you said it perfectly. There's a more of a hybrid model. We want the easy subscription model, so it's always there, but we also want that extra little value, extra little bit of personalization rather than that cookie cutter approach of that's what it is. That's what is coming out of the box. And that's where I think the next level of growth is going to be. It's not just purely on SaaS. And VCs are even seeing that today. They're looking at it and they're saying, do you know what? That was where we were going before, but actually the amount of time and effort and money it's taking to control the churn and keep having to get new people on board, right, there's a better way of revenue generation from that. And that is pushing towards that revenue model.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you look at traditional SaaS companies, right? And again, we have a number of them in our portfolio. So this is just kind of the reality. I think, you know, what you see is unless you're growing at a really, really significant rate, that you get to that point around 10 million or so, that plateau, and in a market like this, you know, that where churn, you know, even if you're at, you know, kind of top quartile performance in SaaS and your churn is, you know, only 10%, right? So you're, you know, 90% gross retention, which, you know, by any measure, real solid gross retention. Your first $1 million of growth every year is just trying to replace what you just lost, right? It just becomes harder and harder to do that. You know, it's a challenge. And I think, you know, you combine that with sort of the forces around SaaS pricing and things, it's just going to require a different way to think about growth. I think that's really, really tied to the value that somebody is deriving. And also, as much as I hate to say it, the usage.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
It's totally dirty word in SaaS, right? Like, you know, but
yeah. So, that being said, so we know what's getting to work, where we believe the industry is going to be heading, and then what's going to be sort of put by the sideline. But one thing that we can't really get away from, especially within the tech industry, is what I call the demo loop. When they're getting into it and they get stuck in this demo loop, sales cycles are obviously taking longer and longer and longer, because it seems like everybody and their dog now needs to get into the buying process and the buying decision process. Right. And therefore, we're getting stuck in this, got to do another demo. What insights or advice would you have, or probably insights from your portfolio that those are there that say, this is how we break that. We've got to take back control. We've got to take back the frame. We've got to start taking and not handing so much power over to the buyer now and start guiding them into how to buy.
Yeah. You know, that statement that you just made, the end of that last sentence is guiding them to how to buy, right? Is a really, really important one. And I think, you know, a lot of founders that I see and a lot of leadership teams and high growth companies, like they've never been buyers themselves. They don't necessarily, this is especially the case when you start to get into enterprise, right? They don't necessarily understand what a corporate buying process looks like. And then you start to take more, you add some risk aversion, you know, where there's like a, you know, more of a risk on kind of environment inside those companies. And that's where you see this demo loop, right? It's like, okay, you know, I think I want to do it, but we got to pull, you know, these buying committees become enormous, even for relatively small sales. Right. And I think teaching your buyer how to buy, because we take it for granted that they may not actually have any idea. They probably are not purchasing your CRM software or your, you know, hiring solution or your health and safety software or something, right? You really, you know, they're not normally buying that. They don't necessarily normally know what to look for. And what they really likely don't know is how to build a business case. Right. So I think it's teaching them, here's what the value that you're going to derive. Here's what the value from a solution like this. Forget our solution. Here's how you need to be thinking about ROI, right? Here's how you need to be thinking about value from an investment like this. Then let's talk about how we can deliver that value, but really teaching them, you know, here's what a process and guiding that process. I see this in our portfolio. I see it in companies I coach. They're just acquiescing, right, to what is being asked. Okay, now can you do another demo for Gary? Sure. Now can you do another demo for Greg? Yeah. Now can you do another demo for Ira? It's like, okay, wait a second. Here's how this process typically looks. One of the things that we coach our founders to do is have a simple slide, right? Here's the process. Here are the five steps in typically our selling process or whatever it is. You, Gary, my prospect, does that make sense to you? Is this a process that we think you can follow? If not, let's modify it together so we both understand exactly what's going on here, right? I think that guidance of the process becomes a really, really important thing. And to be ahead of ROI, do not assume that your prospect understands what the value that they're going to purchase, because they're thinking, most of the time, they're thinking value in terms of functionality. One of the things we talk about, Gary, all the time with our founders, and this is a lot of the stuff we coach on as well, that I coach on as well, is around this concept of a horizon metric, right? It's one metric. There is something. There's a core reason that your buyer is buying your software that they're not articulating to you, right? But there's something under there. They're talking about it in terms of workflow. They're talking about it in terms of all these boring company terms, right? Well, we need a better workflow for our sales force to do blah, 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 blah. But there's something underneath it. What's the pain that they're really, truly trying to solve? But what is that underlying issue that they're trying to solve, right? And then orient your company. So this is that nexus, right? Orienting your company around that single metric. So I'll give you an example of a company I work with right now, right? Sales enablement CRM. You ask customers the biggest reason that they're saying that they need to buy, well, we need automation for our sales force to accelerate the, you know, sales cycle, and we want to automate this and automate that. But really what they're trying to do is help the rep sell more. Like, nobody's saying it like that, but that's it. And at the end of the day, within that organization, that's all they really care about. Right? There's nothing more to it. So, you know, the functionality is the how, but that's the why. We need to help our reps sell more consistently, sell more whatever, fill in the blank, right? And then orienting the company, orienting the actual organization, the startup, around that single metric. So if you're out building product that doesn't help the rep sell more, if you're out communicating in your messaging something about functionality and not how it helps reps sell more. If you're talking about something else out in marketing except that, you're missing the boat, right? So it's that horizon metric to align company startup operations with that core reason that a company buys. And I think that that will help guide the process as well, because it just gets everybody clear about what are we doing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's finding it. And this is what I'm finding with, especially within the tech, and I've seen it in the engineering, and I've seen it obviously in accountancy as well, but especially in tech, is there's this, I'll build it, they will come, because it's so great. And therefore I only have to talk about its functionality because it's going to be absolutely super, as opposed to, and this is why they're finding themselves stuck in the sea of sameness, because everyone's sounding the same. No one's actually stepping out and saying, I can fix your bleeding neck problem. That's the problem you have. How I can come out there and fix that problem.
Right.
So that leads us really into authority, because obviously in our realm, with what we're doing, is building authority to sell more. That's basically what it's coming above that noise. Yeah. You studied some really great high-performing founders. How important is this personal branding and authority building for businesses today?
You know, it's definitely becoming more important, right? I mean, the corporate brand, there are definitely some notable exceptions, right? If you're Tesla, you're SpaceX, you're Amazon, you're Apple, your corporate brand is obviously has an enormous amount of equity. Most companies, that's not going to be the case. That's not ever going to be the case. And that brand, that company brand becomes less and less authentic to the buyer than the actual story, right? And, you know, I bring it really back to, when you think about personal branding for a founder, I bring it back to the story, right? What is the unique story that you have? Every startup, every founder has a compelling story. What is it? Why did you really do this, right? And just simply tell that story. Like, it's an important part of your sales process. It's an important part of your marketing. You are so many founders at that early stage. They are the business. I think, you know, my previous companies, I mean, we were probably north of 10 million before other people, like, there were sales happening where I wasn't involved on some level and things like that. But it was that personal story that people are buying into. And I think that, to me, that's the branding, right? It's also, you know, I love when founders kind of tell the story of the startup they're building in public, right? You know, they're telling the story of the startup, struggles and all, as they go. And it just becomes so authentic and so real that it really does become part of that brand. I think it's just becoming more and more important. It's a tiny, tiny, tiny percentage of founders who are willing to do it. But I think the ones who do, it can really have a pretty compelling impact. You know, instead of going out and nobody cares about your company LinkedIn page, right? I mean, you know, we've dealt with a lot of companies, and, you know, I could probably count the amount of visitors they get on one hand, right? In any given, you know, day or week. And Nobody cares, but they do care about the founder, because that's where the story lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And that, I want to get your insight on this one. I want to get your thoughts on this one, because in tech aren't known for being outgoing, generally. They're not outgoing. So a lot of founders find it really difficult to put themselves in the spotlight and showcase. So yes, I understand. I can tell my story, and I understand that gives me more authentic, but it's not the way I'm built. I'm not built like that. I'd rather be behind a keyboard. I'd rather be behind a screen. I'd rather be behind that. And things. What mindset shifts do they need to start embracing so they can break free of that and start standing really high and above their competition?
Yeah, I think, you know, don't be quick to denigrate it, right? I think is what I would say. It's a difference between, I don't want to be the one to do this, versus, this is bull crap. Sorry, yeah. I don't know if you're allowed to swear or not, but, you know, this is bull, right? And you're not allowed to, you know, I'm just not willing to participate. Those are two really different things. I see founders all the time who say, like, man, I hate this. Like, I don't want to do this, right? So that's fine. Let somebody take pictures, right? Let somebody be there to tell the stories, to ghostwrite it for you. Like, get somebody to help you with this, right? It's okay. You don't have to sit down and write it. Just allow for it to occur in your voice and in your name, right? But that's different from, hey, I just think it's stupid. You know, I'm not doing it. And I've seen founders go that direction, and it's unhelpful, right? If you don't want to be the one to be the face, or you don't want to be the one to have to actually do that work, let somebody do it for you, but tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't agree with you more. It's, as I said, otherwise, if you're not telling your story, no one's telling your story. And if no one's telling your story, then you just sound like everybody else again. And I'll keep coming back to this, but if you keep sounding like everybody else, then you're just lost in all the noise, and you've got to do something different to break free from that. You just have to, if you want to succeed and really break through and go move forward.
And I want to talk about, just to add one sort of point there. One thing I would add is it's the one thing that's uniquely yours, right? Because most, you know, look, I don't care what you're starting today, unless you're starting, you know, sex, or and even that has Blue Origin, right? Even that's got a competitor. You know, unless you're, there's almost nothing that you're going to be starting that is so profoundly differentiated that it's going to be enough, right? But the story of the startup, that is uniquely your story. Nobody can copy that. You own it.
It's yours. And then so many stories come off that. Yeah, because you can just keep delving there. It's not just one linear story. There are so many lessons and things that you can show your authenticity. And this, you know, we're seeing founder-led sales to a degree, all the way up to 15, 20 million. 15, 20 million dollar companies are still doing founder-led sales to some degree.
Absolutely.
But I see so many of them just dump this marketing onto a marketing team or a marketing agency or a marketing thing as soon as they get to a million or something and stop doing it. And it just loses all that panache and passion that they had in the first place from doing it.
Yeah, give me leads, right? Becomes the kind of the mantra. And it's just, that's not, you know, I think about, you know, look, we did so many things wrong, right? But one of the things, you know, in my last, you know, company that I think we did right was we just had a lot of fun with the brand early on. We took chances with the brand, we took risks with it, and we just had fun because it just became, and we were in the HR tech world, right? I mean, we're selling HR people. This is not, you know, this is not known for its like out there innovation as a market, right? Highly risk averse. But we could take risks with the story. We could take risks with the brand. And it just, you know, it made us come to life in a different way than our competitors did. And it worked.
Yeah. That's a really, really good point. Really good point. Well, as we're drawing to the end of our time and our interview together, and, you know, I say this almost on every episode, you know, I'm so grateful for the guests we have because time flies so quickly because we're having such great fun at doing it. I'll be doing the listeners and this and you as well if we don't talk about navigating investor relationships.
Yeah.
There's going to be people out there who are probably at a stage now where they're thinking, okay, outside investment, got to get some more. What are the top three tips you could give people for the best way to navigate this? Because it is a bit of a jungle out there, you know, that no one's really teaching you the right way. And if they are, they're sort of pulling you from pillar to post.
Yeah.
So what would you say is the top three tips you could give people on this?
So number one, I'm going to go back to what I said before about strategic accountability, one of the four pillars, right? With your current investors, nothing builds your ability to go raise more money. The easiest target, just like sales, right? The easiest target you have to raise more money is from your current investors. Just like the easiest revenue you can get is from your current clients, same thing goes with investors. Be transparent, be coachable, be somebody they want to invest in. Be somebody that is actively listening to what they're saying. Doesn't mean you're doing everything they say. I'm an investor myself. I come up with more bad suggestions than I come up with good ones, right? I do not expect every founder to go do everything. Pray to God they don't go do everything. Sort of hatchet, right? But I want to have a dialogue. I want to be a strategic partner, a thought partner with them. And that's just a really important point. Be accountable, be vulnerable, admit when you screwed up, ask for help when you need it, right? That's going to be what builds that relationship with your current investors to open that source of funding for you. The thing I would also tell, you know, talk about with new investors, in fundraising is not a point in time. I get pitched every day, every single day. If I showed you my LinkedIn, it's ridiculous. Like the amount of random DMs I'm getting with people, I have no idea what they're doing. I don't know who they are. It's okay to send that random pitch, but what is going to differentiate is picking those few investors that have some experience in your space and building a relationship. Almost every dollar that I raised, Gary, came from companies or came from investors that I had building relationship with for multiple years, right? And every quarter, I told them our story. I updated our story. Hey, Gary, the investor, here's what I said we were going to do last quarter. We came close. We missed a little bit over here. We nailed it over here. How are you seeing the space? What do you think is evolving? What are the things that you think I should be thinking about? I made them a part of my advisory board, right? Before they even knew it and I even knew it, right? But we're developing a relationship together. And, you know, that became, so then when the time came to raise money, it was, hey, Gary, look, we're actually starting to think about a raise right now. Awesome. Let's talk about it. Right? Because they knew the story. They knew me. I had been keeping them up to date. So don't treat this as a point in time kind of situation. Bring the story along. Don't blast out to everybody out there. Really go out and find those investors who are best suited for what you're doing. It takes a little bit of digging, but just like in sales, figure out your ICP, right? And then use that ICP to start to build a relationship. It doesn't happen overnight, but it's gonna take time. Mm. And I think the third thing I would say, build a great business, right? One of the things that scares me as an investor away from a lot of businesses, I can sniff out businesses that are, I mean, there's these sort of what I would call chronic fundraisers that are out there, right? Where the competency of the business appears to be fundraising, right? There's not a lot of talk of the business, right? There's a lot of talk about fundraising, deal structure, things like that. Build a great business that people want to invest in. Right? Focus there. Let the easiest money that's ever going to come is money when people are coming to you, but that requires you to build a foundationally strong business. Don't be afraid to get profitable. Don't be afraid to have slower growth where you can tell the story of, hey, if we jump, but it's very predictable, right? Build a predictable business that people can see, hey, if we add a little bit more gas to this and we put a dollar in the bottom, we are in the top of the funnel, we believe that we can see how $3 comes out. I invest all the time and I joke with founders about this. I mean, I don't invest. I look at deals all the time where it's like, look, if I stick a dollar in the top of the funnel, what actually comes out the bottom? I mean, sometimes it's another dollar, other times it's a nickel, and sometimes it's like a zebra, right? And I have no, like, there's no predictability to this whatsoever. And I think that's what you need to get to. But that requires building a foundationally strong business.
No, that's fantastic. I love those three things. Listen, one of my guilty pleasures on these podcasts is always that I have always a loaded question to ask as a final question to my guests. Good. And you have given so much advice during our time together today that, you know, I'm thinking, well, what could I possibly ask? Usually it's always around, you know, what advice would you give? What if you had to distill the whole interview, what would it be? But I'm going to go a little bit curveball-y here, and I'm going to ask a different type of question. As you've given so much today on this, there's going to be founders here, no doubt, who are listening, who are now thinking, gosh, there's so much I didn't think about, you know, and this is probably one of the reasons why I feel stuck. If a founder is feeling overwhelmed today or stuck, here's your question. If a founder is listening and they suddenly found themselves stuck in this procrastination loop, they just can't get past where they need to get to, what is one immediate action you could give them that'll just get them back on track and moving forward again?
Get a coach or a mentor. Get somebody who has experience, who has done this before, that can help be that voice. There are few more lonely jobs in the world than being the CEO of your own company. Everybody is relying on you, right? If you've got a family, it makes it even harder, right? You've got investors, you've got employees, you've got customers. The weight of the world is on your shoulders. Get help. Talk to a coach, talk to a mentor, talk to somebody with experience. You will be amazed how easy it is if you reach out to somebody and it makes sense, right? Hey, I know that you've built something like this before. I need some help. Can you just help guide me a little bit? People will respond. I mean, it's amazing how willing people are to just give back, you know, but get that person that can be that sounding board, be that person sitting there on your side to be the shoulder to cry on, to be the person to give you a kick in the butt to say, get over yourself, right? Or that person to say, hey, I hear your idea. I see where you're coming from. Let's kind of beat that up a little bit, right? You have to have it. You've got to have it. And your employees and people inside your company, they're not the right people for that because they're relying on you too, right? As much as you love them, they're relying on you too.
Well, that is a brilliant place to land. You know, don't be scared to reach out. There are people out there who are more than willing to help you. You just got to ask. They're not mind readers. Reach out to them and they'd be surprised. I think it's Greg, that's a fantastic piece of advice to finish our interview on. Now, if people want to get to know, more about what you do, if you can help them or more about their book, what's the best way of getting hold of you?
Yeah, sure. So easiest way is just find me on LinkedIn, right? It's just, / Greg Moran, GREGMORAN, just as it sounds. Super active on LinkedIn. Drop me a message there. You can email me directly if you want to at greg@emep, that stands for Evergreen Mountain Equity Partners, emep.io. Book is coming out right around March 1st. So if you're interested in ordering a copy, we can get you through the Evergreen Mountain. If you go to emep.io, there's a landing page on there where you can put in for a pre-order of the book as well. I'm super easy to find. I'm all over LinkedIn, a little less on X, but all over LinkedIn or just email me.
I'll make sure those links go into the show notes below so people can get hold of you. Well, Greg, thank you very much for your time today. Not only your time, but your insights, your expertise. You've given so much today. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on today.
Likewise, Gary. Appreciate you having me on. We'll see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Growth Focus Podcast. No doubt you'll have taken so many insights or just little bits of information that you could use to grow your business. And if you have, do not keep them to yourself. Please make sure that you share this to others who need to hear it as well. Remember, we grow by helping others grow as well. So until next time, guys, keep striving, keep being profitable, and we'll see you on the next episode. Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye-bye.